We get it. You're busy. You want to grow, and we want to help. You're passionate about your craft because it deeply matters to you. Your faith is important. It's your foundation. At Stayforth, we coach leaders to avoid burnout, live and lead with clarity, purpose, and from a place of health. We want you to experience long-term impact. Welcome to the journey.
Well, friends, welcome back to the podcast. And first of all, I want to start by thanking our sponsors, Reach the Lost. They're one of our sponsors here on Stayforth Leadership Podcast, enabling us to bring great content to you guys. And I also have Ryan Clark, who leads Reach the Lost, who's going to talk a little bit more about what they do. Ryan, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Alan.
So why? Let's start with the why behind why you guys do what you do. Why are you guys so passionate about helping churches?
Yeah, I'll start with a story because for us, it's like our why is really deep. We named it Reach the Lost for a reason because we're like, man, we have a heartbeat in our DNA to reach people who don't know Jesus yet. And so our community was just totally wrecked with suicide, depression. Mm-hmm. We're like, man, how could we get in front of that? And so we're like, if we really believe that the church is the hope of the world through Jesus, man, we got to intercept searches. And so that's what we talk about, intercepting searches for churches. Like we want to help churches get in front of things that matter most in their community.
And one of the things that I heard about at first was this Google grant. And I thought, no, that's too good to be true. $10,000 a month of free ad spend. Talk a little bit about the Google grant and even how you help churches to utilize that.
Yeah, I'll start with the word we hear a lot, like, hey, is this a scam? And we're like, hey, no, it's not. So, you know, Google does this because it's a huge tax write-off and benefit for them, and they want good publicity. So I just wanted to kind of debunk that because a lot of people are like, Google is not helping us out in this way, but they really are. They're helping 501c3s. And so why does this matter for your local churches? It's a lot of money. $10,000 a month, it goes a long way. It ends up being about like 3,000 to 5,000 clicks for a church within a 20-mile radius. So if you think of, I've always wanted to get in front of churches near me, or how to save my marriage, or how to get out of debt, like we can get your church in front of those type of searches.
Awesome. So, well, yeah, we really appreciate what you guys do, and they're a formal and official partner with Stayforth. You'll hear from Ryan again on the podcast, but I would encourage you, if you are a church leader and you guys want to expand your reach in the community, some of those unique pain points that you are burdened by and that rest on your shoulders as a leader that you just can't shake, to get an intro call with Ryan, learn a little bit more about what they do and how they could specifically serve your church. How can folks get a hold of you guys?
Yeah, if you go to reachthelost.com, there's a big book a call button, and that'll actually come straight to me, and I'd love the opportunity to connect.
Awesome. Thanks for what you do. Thanks for coming on the podcast. And now, on to our episode. Hey, friends. Welcome back to the podcast. And this is a fun one. This is a special one. For me, I've got my older bro, J.R. Briggs, here on the podcast. Does so many of the same things that I do, but just in a different way, in a different manner. Author, coach, thought leader in so many different ways, and just constantly looking for threads that we need to be talking about as a leader. So, dude, it's great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's good to be with you. Glad we can do this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not the most fun topic necessarily, really crucial topic, and one that I think is incredibly important for us, especially as we head into the election season heating up. And so we're talking about cynicism. And I'm just curious for you, we started to have some relational discussions about this. You've written about this, starting to speak about this. But when did you start to pay attention to kind of this cultural cynicism that we're experiencing?
Well, as a leadership coach, I certainly, just like you, have the privilege of working with leaders, many different industries, sectors, backgrounds, experiences. And it's a joy to serve in those ways. And as I've been doing that, and I've been noticing that cynicism has been taking root in the lives of many leaders, and just trying to notice how it sneaks out, what it sounds like. And I've started to look around culture, and we see, you know, cynicism is everywhere. And noticing that not only cynicism, is it not penalized, cynical people are actually being applauded, promoted, and platformed. And of course, it's big on social media. And as I've been working, there's one leader who for years has battled cynicism in his own life. There was a 2-year stretch where he kind of fought these internal soundtracks daily, like nobody will change, what you're doing won't make a difference, you're wasting your time because it doesn't matter. And nobody knew that this leader was struggling. And I think that's the hard thing about cynicism, because externally everything seemed fine, but no one knew the truth that he was weighed down by this cynical spirit and it was suffocating. And that leader was me. And so I knew I needed to pay attention to this, because if not, it has a pernicious effect on our minds, our souls, and how we think about things. So I began to see this in me. I began to see it in culture. I started reading about it, a book on prayer, actually, a guy named Paul Miller. He said that cynicism may be the most damaging thing on our prayer life. And I thought, huh, that's quite a statement. And the more I've drilled down in that, the more I agree with them. So it's personal, cultural, reading, kind of all these coalescing and going, yeah, it's the spirit of our age. It's everywhere.
Before we push further into that and pull that thread, define, how do you define cynicism?
Yeah, cynicism is where we mistrust the intentions of other people. I think that's the easiest way to describe it. We mistrust the intentions of other people. It's the belief that everyone is in it for their own self-interest. There's always an ulterior motive someone else has, and therefore no one can be trusted. And it's where we say in ourselves, I know best, I am knowledgeable enough to know what's really going on, and you don't. It's like a Molotov cocktail of pride, disappointment, apathy, and anger all wrapped together. But ultimately, cynicism is an unhealthy response to disappointed expectations. And the late comedian George Carlin, he said, inside a cynical person, there is a disappointed idealist. And cynicism only happens when we're first disappointed. And so there's disappointment, there's hopelessness, helplessness, and bitterness that kind of comes together. It comes off as smugness. And so cynicism is where we're not only distancing ourselves from someone, we're also standing above them. So it's a bit diagonal. It's condescending. I know better than you do. And also I'm distancing myself from you so I won't get hurt. It's actually a form of preservation. And we sometimes, we conflate the terms cynicism with skepticism. They're not the same thing. And I think it's really important to define the difference on that as well.
Yeah,
skepticism says,
how are they different?
Yeah, skepticism says, I'm not sure, so there's uncertainty and open-mindedness, which is good. We need that. But but cynicism assumes a posture of close-mindedness. I know. Yeah. And I know where skepticism is, I'm not sure. And so one is kind of almost like scratching our chin, like, let me think about that more, where cynicism kind of has our arms crossed and says, like, nope, I know that's not true. And so cynicism hardens and distances us and attempts to elevate ourselves, where cynicism or skepticism says, let me lean in and think about that a little bit more.
Yeah, it's interesting as you say that. There was a gathering that I attended, and you're in a lot of these as one of those lunches, and you know, there's 20 incredible leaders around the table kind of thing. And I talked to one afterwards, and there was this new idea, this new program that was being launched. And I called this guy afterwards on the phone. You know, when you kind of compare notes, what do you think? How is this? And it was interesting is that I was skeptical, but hopeful. And what I sensed from him was that he was cynical. Here's why it's not going to work. I've been down this road before. And it was like it was a risk just to believe in the thing. And I'm like, am I a fool here? Because this is a really smart guy. And it was interesting. I felt that difference between, you know what, I'm skeptical, but I'm open to it, and I'd love to see it succeed. And it just strikes me like it's like hope is a risk right now. And one that certainly we can feel like a fool sometimes on. And I want to talk about election season, you know, here in a bit, because I think that factors it. It certainly brings it out in me. I don't know about you, but this season is just like, oh, I've been here before, not again kind of thing. But leaders specifically, that's who's listening. That's who we talk to, work with specifically. How might this hit leaders a little bit differently than just sort of a normal, everyday friend of ours? How's this hitting leaders?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, more is caught than taught, and people look to leaders more often. And so when you get a whiff of cynicism, you know, just like fear, cynicism is contagious. And so we have to be really, really careful. I think the best definition, you know, people say, what's your definition of leadership? I would say, well, a leader is someone who builds trust, bears pain, and brings hope. And when we're cynical, we can't do any of those things because cynical people erode trust, they bring more pain, and they don't often bring any hope. And so, yes, cynicism is everywhere in our culture. It's the spirit of our age. It's the air that we breathe. But we have to lead people towards hope. I don't know a single leader who isn't leading people towards hope. And so I think the most countercultural thing we can do as leaders, especially those who are faith leaders, is bring hope. And the best leaders that I know have a healthy balance between reality and hope. If you have too much hope and not enough reality, it sounds like a really bad Hallmark card.
Right.
If you have too much reality and no hope, it's really depressing. And that's where cynicism sets in. And so we've got to double major in reality and in hope. And it's hard. It's a balance. It's a struggle. It's a fight that is worth fighting against, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Like my commitment is to be a grounded optimist. And sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm just being a realist. And it's like, yeah, really, you're kind of a bummer right now. And not bringing hope to the situation. That's a tension for sure. Mm-hmm. Talk about election season. Actually, get personal. How has election season impacted you in this way the last two cycles?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's important for me to stay off of the news feeds. So I think there was a time where I was, I'm really careful. I am not co-opted by one side or the other. If I read an online news outlet on one side, my next click is always to the other side as well, because I want to make sure that I'm hearing from both perspectives. And so, so there's that. I think as a leader too, you know, politics is a secular religion, right? So it's no secret we live in an age of distrust. And right now, you know, scandals and corrupt institutions, misinformation, disinformation, AI generated images, intentionally false messages created by endless bots, social media influencers that feel a little too polished and perfect on their feeds. You know, a trust-starved culture is just a petri dish where cynicism just grows rapidly. So I think politics, it just continues to feed into that. And one of the best things I can do is to starve myself from some of those elements that erode things from my soul. And so for me, like, it's taken a chunk out of it. And I think that when things start to go political in terms of conversation, I think my first inclination is to duck out as politely and quickly as I can. sometimes that means staying off of social media for a few days or a few weeks. And sometimes that's just literally trying to exit a conversation as quickly as I can as well. So yeah, it's hard. I have to fight against it. I don't want to be an ostrich with my head in the sand. But there are times where I just need to create some healthy boundaries and barriers for myself on that. So it's hard. I'm still wrestling through it. One of the things you won't see on my social media feeds is talking about politics. So I don't want to feed that myself. I don't want to listen to others. Not that there's a difference between sharing your opinions for the sake of help me learn and know more versus sharing opinions to ram it down someone's throat or to try to change someone's mind. And we know how often someone's mind is changed by a condescending and arrogant political post on social media. The answer, of course, is zero.
Best place to learn, man. Best place to soak in wisdom. I was actually struck by it. I was on the treadmill the other day, and there's just, you know, too many TVs. I like want to go there to escape a little bit. I'm like listening to a nourishing podcast, and it's just like I could see these two networks airing and warring. And it's like, I wonder who I'm running next to, like which one they're paying attention to. It was interesting. I've noticed politically, actually, I have quite a bit of hope, but it had to start at the basic level, at my city level. And so I have never actually participated in our mayor race before. And we've talked about this. A friend of mine that's become a friend of yours as well was in our mayor race, and we were so excited for the process. And I was like, man, I don't know much about our local mayor race. I don't even know how it works. I don't even know how the runoff goes. And so I actually had to just confess to other people, like, just yeah, I've never actually done this before. And there were all these younger people waking up, or at least middle-aged people waking up to, yeah, like maybe it could be different in our city. And that's actually been really good for my heart. He ended up winning and going on a listening tour for his first 100 days in our city. And it's interesting how that impacted me, even to go like, wow, this was a risk to care. Like, what if we put all this energy and effort in and we're fools and we lose? But that's the risk in taking that. So that was a really interesting thing for me. And also to say, I think the political season will heat up. We need to be ready for it. But I also don't, it's not going to be exactly like it was 4 years ago and exactly like it was 8 years ago. And so I'll just say on air, that's a challenge for me, is the political season. And I just like, oh, no more people behaving badly and yelling at each other on social media and all that. So I'm wrestling with what's my posture going to be, and how do we bring people together here in this season. Man, talk about practices. Obviously, being careful in politics and what you just shared there, but what are some practices that you, as sort of a recovering cynical leader, are guarding your heart with?
Yeah, well, it's become so normalized. I think we have to start by noticing it in our culture and in ourselves, and inviting others in to notice it when they see it in us. I think that's a really important thing. It's also important to remind ourselves that sarcasm, which is a sneaky sister of cynicism, is not a fruit of the Spirit. We sometimes, even in the church, forget that sarcasm is not a fruit of the Spirit. And before I get to practices, I just want to mention, what makes cynicism so dangerous is that it doesn't attack us and grab us by the neck and whack us over the head. It's a slow creep. It's kind of like carbon monoxide or a leaky roof, that if you ignore it, it'll only get worse. Maybe the best metaphor that I've come across is, it's cynicism is like a boa constrictor, right? They don't attack you and, you know, spit venom on you and you die within seconds. They wrap around you, and every time you exhale, you know, they squeeze a little bit tighter and a little bit tighter and a little bit tighter until they just squeeze the life out of you. And that's what cynicism does to our soul. So it won't destroy you immediately, but if it goes unaddressed, it will wreck your soul. And it kills joy, and it erodes hope, and it robs us of the privilege of giving others the benefit of the doubt. So there are several practices, I think. You know, first of all, I mean, there are examples of cynicism in Scripture. And so I think that that's really good to notice that. I mean, Satan's first question in the garden, did God really say that? The Israelites were cynical toward God wandering the wilderness. Will you really provide for us? Jonah, the whole book of Jonah is pretty much laced with cynicism in his response. And so I think there are two concepts we have to hold in tension as we think about practices. The first one is where Jesus says, be innocent as doves and as wise as snakes. And I just talk about boa constrictors, right? But they talk about wisdom and snakes. But I think that's really important to, you know, because we can be shrewd or wise as snakes. And Dallas Willard talks about, why is a snake shrewd? It's because it knows exactly when to pounce. It's never too early and it's never too late. A snake knows exactly the right time to strike. And so that's it. But we have to do it innocently. And I think we've seen people who are all snake and no dove. We've also seen people who are all dove and no snake, and they get taken advantage of. So I think finding that balance and double majoring in that is important, as well as to be childlike, but not be childish. And I think that's an important distinction. Yeah, I have never met a little child who's cynical, right? Have you? So to have a childlike heart, which Jesus invites us into, but we're also told to grow up. And so to find that balance of growing up, but remaining childlike. So there are some creative practices that I've engaged with. Oftentimes when I speak on cynicism to a group, I'll put up a list of 10 or 12 practices and I'll say, don't do all of these. Don't try all of these. Just pick one or two. And just attempt these in a ridiculously specific and practical way. And so one I mentioned is just noticing it and inviting other people to kind of appropriately call it out in you, I think is really good. I keep a daily gratitude journal. It's not anything new. It's been around a long time, but I write 5 things that I'm grateful for every morning when I sit down with my coffee and my journal, because I find that gratitude and cynicism have a difficult time coexisting. But even just engaging in the spiritual practice of giving people the benefit of the doubt, I think that's a huge one. If we can just practice giving people the benefit of the doubt, it helps to erode the cynicism that may be setting in. I find that watching children play is important, of just literally getting down cross-legged and playing Legos with a little kid or rolling a ball with them helps me stay childlike. And then also just purposefully surrounding myself with other tender-hearted, hope-filled, joy-saturated people. You know, if cynics are fault finders, you know, the Apostle Paul says that love always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Like, I need to be around those always kind of people and not be around fault finders. You know, show me your friends, I'll show you your future. Well, I want to surround myself with non-cynical people. And in a world saturated by cynicism, I think the most revolutionary thing we can do is to embrace and articulate hope, but it means we need to be around people, even little tiny people, young people, who articulate and live out hope as well.
That's good. Yeah, what else? What else on cynicism do listeners need to hear?
Yeah, well, I find it interesting in doing a deep dive on cynicism of learning about the history of cynicism, that there was actually a philosophical school of cynicism in ancient Greece in the 4th century BC. And it was started by a student of Aristotle, and it explored like really important questions about human nature and customs and shame. But they believed that the highest form of wisdom was to not live by any socially constructed customs and even laws. And so the idea of shamelessness and self-sufficiency were really key virtues. So the goal is to kind of shock people with questions about these unspoken societal rules that existed. And I found it so fascinating. In fact, the word cynic or cynicism means dog-like in Greek. And it's kind of a nod to an animal's scrappiness and lack of inhibition. And they don't really care about social graces or socially constructed laws or rules. And so the most famous cynic that kind of made the school of cynicism famous was a guy named Diogenes. And he was just this really eccentric dude. He Plato referred to him as Socrates gone mad. In fact, he found a really large clay jar and he lived in it the rest of his life. And, you know, that sounds silly, but it was even worse. Like, he would urinate on people in public that he didn't like. He would defecate in public outside, and sometimes he'd go into the theater and he would just defecate, trying to communicate that, like, who said this was wrong? And so he was nicknamed Diogenes the dog, but it was considered a compliment to him. So all that to say, you know, like, think, man, how did we get from that, this philosophy school, to where we are today? But I would argue that's an important thing to know, because there are a lot of Diogeneses, if that's a word, a lot of Diogeneses today. We may not live in clay pots, but
we may not be defecating on our friends or neighbors.
That's what I'm saying. That's the point I'm trying to make here, is that aren't cynics today those who think that everyone else has it wrong? And aren't we metaphorically urinating and defecating on others' ideas by assuming the worst in them? And aren't cynics brutishly dog-like in how they act? And so I think we actually are closer to the original term of cynicism, of being dog-like, more than we think. And so I just, because it's boa constrictor-like, like carbon monoxide, we can't see it, we can't smell it, it doesn't attack us and pounce us and kill us immediately. We just have to be so careful, because it's so sinister and it's so sneaky. We just have to get it under control. And I think one of the best things we can do is just to ask other people around us, hey, I don't know if I'm struggling with cynicism, but I need to be open to it. Can you give me the last 5% of the truth about my level of cynicism? Am I cynical? If so, where? I want to grow.
That's good. This is a unique episode in that there's not a book that we're selling on the other side of this. And really the next step is not external, go do this, but is internal. And as we've been doing here on the podcast, we're actually just going to leave you with some time to reflect on this. We are a coaching organization, which means that we are a question asking organization. And so we're just going to leave you some time. We're going to leave some music here in the background. So as you drive, as you do dishes, as you're working out, please hang on for just a few minutes and think about this question: is where is cynicism sneakily coming for you in your life? Where is cynicism sneakily coming for you in your life? Thanks for joining us for this episode. Reflect on that, friends. We can't take action when we're not aware.